I'm joined today by Colonel Douglas McGregor, and I appreciate him coming on. I want to get down to the truth about what's going on with Ukraine, Putin, this war that we've all been roped into. I believe the mainstream media is misleading Americans with propaganda in order to justify the use of our tax dollars and the military-industrial complex. So thank you, sir, so much for coming on today.
Sure, absolutely.
So the first question that I wanted to get down to is, who is it that really wants this war between NATO and Vladimir Putin? Because from what I'm seeing outside of CNN and other mainstream media is it seems like it's the politicians in Washington, D.C. that are more eager to fight this battle through Ukraine against Putin. And it doesn't seem as if the Pentagon is as on board as the politicians. Who's really behind wanting this war?
Well, I think it's clear that the American people are largely divorced from the reality of this conflict as they have been for the last 30 years, divorced from all the conflicts. War has always been something that happened far away on somebody else's soil. The difference this time is that Washington has decided, along with help and assistance, particularly from its allies in London and the global financial community run out of New York City, to wage war on the Russian state with the goal of not simply regime change, but ultimately destroying the state, potentially dismembering it. And when you look at the people who are advocates for this terrible, destructive policy, they are largely the same people that got us into the Balkans in the 1990s, into Bosnia and Kosovo, and then subsequently were largely supportive of the interventions in 2001 and 3 for perpetual warfare in the Middle East, demonizing and transforming into an enemy Libya, Syria, and obviously Iran. This is an old story. It's the same old trope that you've been hearing. It's 1936 again. We have another potential Hitlerian state. And if we don't act, we are appeasers and the world as we know it will end. So that's about it. But I think there's a lot of money behind this because Russia is full of trillions of dollars of resources, mineral resources, oil, gas, precious metals, agricultural. We just go down the list. There was an attempt in the 90s and in the early part of this century by people from the West, many of whom are connected to organizations like Goldman Sachs and the global financial community, to go in and effectively rape Russia and steal everything they possibly could from it. They were ultimately defeated and thrown out by Vladimir Putin, who established a new regime to bring some more stability and dignity back to the Russian state. He has been talking now for many, many years about the unacceptable policy of advancing NATO to Russia's borders. And he's been warning over and over and over again, if you do this, you will inevitably come into conflict with us. We will not tolerate a large NATO presence. And when you say NATO presence, read the potential for U.S. ballistic and cruise missiles and so forth on the border. And we've taken the position in Washington, that is the political elite, the ruling elite of our country, that Russia is weak, that Russia can be bullied, and all we have to do is apply great pressure. And since we dominate the global financial system, we can isolate it. And this ruling political elite embraces most of both parties. And so we are embarked upon this very dangerous course of conflict and confrontation now with the Russian state and its armed forces. The Washington community that sponsors this has obviously enriched itself over the last 30 plus years through all the various interventions and the massive increases in defense spending. But it actually goes beyond that. It goes to the reconstruction costs, rebuilding costs, and the introduction of U.S. firms and interests into other countries. It's a kind of new imperialism that we've been embarked upon. And Russia is simply the latest target. The problem for the ruling elites in Washington is twofold. First of all, most of them are ignorant of reality. They know nothing about the world beyond our borders. They know nothing about military power. And so they badly miscalculated with Russia. This was a war that should have ended in a few weeks because Russia would collapse, or at least in a few months because Russia would collapse. This is a war that should have ended because Russia can't produce enough ammunition. This is a war that should have ended because of horrendous and horrific casualties taken exclusively by the Russians. And all we have to do is arm this proxy, this Ukrainian force that we built after 2014, once we had established a government in Kiev that would do our bidding, and this force in Ukraine would devastate Russia. Well, it hasn't quite worked out that way, has it? So now we face a very different set of circumstances. But when you ask who is behind it, you've got to look at a whole range of people. And remember that the preeminent goal in Washington for most politicians is to stay in office and continue to enrich themselves. Therefore, they pay a great deal of attention to their donors. Who are the donors? You have to go and look at the oligarchic class of people that drive policy, that keep us in a state of perpetual conflict with a whole range of people and nations. Who are they? Then look at the industries in which they are invested and which support these policies. When you look at those things carefully, in other words, it boils down very simply to follow the money. When you do that, you begin to understand that what's happening in Washington has nothing to do with the American people or United States interests. No one in the United States, or very few people in the United States, know where Ukraine is. They could care less. And when you ask about NATO, people will say, oh, yeah, sure, that's important, I guess. What is it? this is the problem with just about everything, I think, that's been happening in the United States since the end of the Second World War. Most Americans aren't terribly interested on what goes on beyond the borders of their own country. I mean, frankly, most of what happens around the world on any given day doesn't make much difference to us. So you've got a ruling class that says, no, we want to be engaged everywhere because it's beneficial. That ruling class is diverse, but again, it embraces both sides of the political spectrum. That's why if you're expecting a Republican-controlled House to suddenly dramatically, shift into reverse gear and stop something, you're very much mistaken. Most of them will vote with the left, just as most of the left will vote with them. Why? To keep the money flowing. It benefits them because it benefits their donors. And again, there's no understanding. If you look at this balloon business, if I could just stop for a second. We sent an F-22, the most expensive aircraft ever built, out to shoot down a balloon. And the Chinese had told us, well, it's a weather balloon. But of course, you never believe anything the Chinese say because the Chinese are now enemies and they always lie. But let's look at the facts. The Chinese have 300 satellites, 300 in space. Of that number, almost a third have military application. The Chinese have their own global positioning system, just like the Russians, just as we do. They have the same capability to monitor what happens from 100,000 feet in space that we do. They can read the names on gravestones, and if they want to monitor the conversations in the White House, they can do it. All right. Why are we worried about this flimsy balloon that is too small to carry a significant payload? It can't even communicate with China. It's on the wrong side of the world. The only way it could communicate is to send data to satellites. Meanwhile, our border is open. Thousands of Chinese, thousands of Russians and others from all over the world have been pouring in. Where are they? What are they doing? Are our nuclear power stations secure? What about these people? Are they near any of our military installations? How many of them are agents? How many Chinese scientists and engineers are working in our laboratories? This is all nonsense, what we're hearing about the stupid balloon. They're missing the point. Washington needs to be held accountable for its incalculable negligence and mendacity. I agree with that. But you're not going to get anything out of the balloon. You need to turn to the really substantive issues. Why are our borders open? Why do we have 100,000 troops in Europe, including almost 50,000 in Poland, and none on our borders? There's no threat to Europe from Russia. Russia is not interested in invading Europe. This is all nonsense. This was cooked up for years to try and demonize Putin and turn him again into another Hitler figure. It's the same old trope. It's the same people doing these things over and over and over again. At some point, the American people need to become engaged and put an end to it. That's the easiest way I can put it.
Yeah. So do you think this spy balloon is to then embarrass President Biden right before the State of the Union? Or because, you know, they started saying, oh, well, they came in with Trump, but now we can't prove it. And you know, national intelligence didn't ever communicate this to that president. Like, is this just a giant distraction for the American people so they don't actually look at what's happening within our own borders or at our border?
Well, I think so. Undoubtedly, you have the usual suspects on the right who will grasp at anything to attack Biden. But the truth is that if you want to go after Biden, you've got lots of reasons to do it. They have nothing to do with the weather balloon. But for some reason, a lot of people on the Hill, I don't think they understand what you and I just discussed. They don't understand the Chinese satellite array. They don't understand that the Chinese from space can track every surface combatant in the United States Navy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And any U.S. surface warship that comes within 200 nautical miles, that location data can be turned into targeting data that results instantly in the launch of missiles to sink it. Now, that's serious. That's a real threat. It doesn't necessarily mean we have to go to war, but it's something we should be aware of. Listening to congressmen and senators talk, you'd think they knew absolutely nothing about the true state of affairs. We can't recruit for our armed forces. People say the volunteer force is imploding. I think there's a lot of evidence for that. Has anybody raised that with Biden? And today, I think it's the CEO of Bank of America is worried about default. You know, and you have Janet Yellen running around as the Secretary of the Treasury saying, well, we could default. We must not default. We've never defaulted. Well, first of all, we have defaulted. We defaulted in 32 and 34. We just called it restructuring the debt. We defaulted in 1971 when we went off the gold standard because we could not cope with the enormous debt being amassed as a result of Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty and the war in Vietnam. So we've been down this road before. Nobody wants to admit those things. So we run around and say, we have to pay our debts. We have to pay our debts. We have to pay our debts. You've got CEOs now saying, how are we going to do that? How is it possible? Nobody's telling the truth about the bond market. You've got to look at everything, the holistic picture. Any normal population with representatives who actually cared about the United States would be addressing these matters and ultimately be arguing for the removal of this president and his administration for incompetence and mendacity. There's no rule of law in our cities anymore. How much criminality do you want in the United States? How much is acceptable? Apparently, we've decided a certain amount of criminality is now acceptable. Yet it's the rule of law in the United States that underpins our economy, has made us great and powerful. And what about all the jobs and the industries that have been shipped overseas? Have they come back? Is there any effort to bring them back? What are we doing? Americans need to wake up. Forget the balloon. These yeah. are serious issues. We got a State of the Union address tonight. What's he going to talk about? Nothing. It'll be another exercise in happy talk because everybody in Washington has figured out that happy talk is the real opium of the people.
Yeah, they got a smoking hopium. We're all just living on hope. Okay, going back to power and Biden, Gerald Celente of the Trends Journal says, when all else fails, they take you to war. You know, there was a RAND report that was put out before the invasion from Russia into Ukraine. Did the United States trigger that invasion in order to bolster Biden in the polls? Or was Putin going to invade regardless, and we just happened to point it out before it happened? What really triggered Putin going into Ukraine?
Well, first of all, discard RAND. RAND is part of the Beltway. It's a status quo think tank that is paid by federal monies. Anything they say is effectively designed to justify, support, extend the status quo.
Okay.
Let's talk about Putin. I told you before that starting with the acquisition of the East European states, these were the ones that were formerly under the Warsaw Pact. The Russians had been told by us that we would not do that. We would not exploit their weakness. in order to advance the borders of NATO further east. We lied. And Putin put up with it. He put up with Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Slovakia, Poland, ultimately Hungary, and Romania and Bulgaria. But then we started talking about Georgia and Ukraine, states that actually border Russia. And he said, no, we're not going to tolerate this. And he told us that if we insisted upon this, they would take action to secure their borders. Now, understand that in Ukraine, we spent a lot of money over the last 10 years. You got to go back to 2014 and look at the coup that brings to power a government that was not duly elected. That government was picked, cultivated, developed, and ultimately led by people from Washington. Victoria Nuland is the most, you know, well-known figure, but she's hardly the only one. And working together with people in the State Department and the same individuals that I mentioned before who were part of the interventions in the Balkans and Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and so forth, all of those people are part of this cabal bringing this war to fruition. Now, in truth, as I said before, they miscalculated. I don't think they believed, frankly speaking, that Putin was going to do what he did. Even in December of 2021, he said, look, I'm willing to talk, but there are certain things you cannot do. We will not accept Ukrainian membership. Ukraine can become neutral. We can talk about that. But I will not tolerate a NATO membership for Ukraine. It poses a threat to us. And of course, we said, oh, well, that's ridiculous. We don't threaten Russia. Well, if you look at Ukraine now, you look at the force we built, you look at all the biolabs we've established in that place, which I think is another issue that deserves closer scrutiny than it's gotten. You begin to say, well, if we had no malicious intent, why were we doing the things we were doing? Why were we building them up? Why were we cultivating the hatred and hostility for Russia? And where did this man Zelensky come from? Remember, Zelensky was an unknown comedian of questionable value who shows up out of nowhere and he becomes the head of state. And remember, he ran on a platform that told the Ukrainians, we want peace with Russia. We have to find a way forward that's peaceful. He was elected overwhelmingly on that platform. Wow. Then he did a 180 and turned into the most, you know, vicious Russian hater and warlike individual they've ever had. The funny thing about Zelensky is that when he was elected, he could not speak a word of Ukrainian. Oh, wow. He grew up speaking only Russian. That was an embarrassment to our State Department, as I learned when I spent some time there. And they worked hard for several months to bring him up to speed. It's not that Ukrainian and Russian are so different that in a few months one can't master the other. But nevertheless, stop and think about that. But he had a huge, huge support from the Ukrainian people, which tells you the masses of Ukrainians want nothing to do with the war against Russia. But this was then brought on. And I think what happened is that the so-called neocon globalists in the Beltway, who are all the various think tanks, thought that Russia could be bullied. And they kept saying, oh, they won't do anything. Putin won't do anything. I was interviewed by Dmitry Symes in January of last year. And I was asked point blank, do you think Russia will go? And I said, absolutely. This is a huge danger to Russian national security. They're not going to sit there. The reason they went into Crimea was not just because historically it had been Russian. They didn't want it to become a NATO naval base in the Black Sea. I mean, there are reasons why actions were taken. So this was foreseeable, but people in Washington miscalculated. And then when Putin went in and essentially moved very carefully and cautiously with a goal of minimizing destruction of human life and property because he did not want a war with the Ukrainian people. Everyone said, oh, well, look at him. Look at the Russians. They're incompetent. They didn't do what we did in Iraq. You know, they did not destroy virtually anything that did not move and then try to attack anything that did. In other words, there was no shock and awe. Well, of course not. That's not what he wanted. And it took several months for him, sadly, and his colleagues in Moscow to figure out there's nobody to talk to. They're not going to negotiate with us. And so we go into this new setting where he says, we've got to go onto a war footing. We're going to have to expand the armed forces. We're going to have to build it up. And then we're going to have to go into an economy of force mode for months until we're ready to strike back. Well, that's what's happened. And the sad part is that all of it was avoidable. It was never necessary. And remember that Mr. Burns, who is the former ambassador to the Soviet or to Russia under, I guess, Obama, he was the one that wrote the memorandum that said no means niet, or niet means no. In other words, don't expand any further. Don't go into Ukraine. And subsequently, he was sent within the last few months to try and hammer out a deal. And that's understandable why he would. Ukraine is falling apart. They are the ones who've taken horrific casualties. They are now dragging 16-year-old boys into the armed forces at gunpoint. They are still taking heavy casualties, and 75% of their casualties have been from artillery systems, strike systems such as rocket artillery, missiles, aviation, and artillery, all of those together, 75% of their casualties. And they can't protect themselves. They don't have the air defense. They don't have the expertise. And we have been feeding them, again, equipment just enough, allegedly, to keep them alive until we finally discovered, my goodness, these people are about to go under. And that's what Secretary Austin effectively told the conference a couple of weeks ago. If we've got to give them this equipment soon because the window of opportunity is closing. Soon we won't be able to affect this. Yeah, of course. And it's all unnecessary. And millions of people are being destroyed by this.
Yeah, it's... It's been very interesting to watch the mainstream media because I cover the news. And so I have to at least see what they're doing, but then get these underground reports from you and from other people, Scott Ritter and others, and really see what's going on. I remember early in the war, I said to my YouTube community, I have no military background, but it seems like Putin is slow walking this invasion in order to get people to flee so that he's not causing mass casualty. And yet the mainstream media perceived that as Putin's weak, but he's also crazy. He's lost his mind. He's this new Hitler. And we were totally being fed a bunch of BS. And now we're saying, okay, wait a minute, this thing's actually going to fall. But now we're sending in tanks and everyone's smoking the hopium that these tanks are going to be the new savior of Ukraine. I know you have, intel and opinions on the tank situation. What's really going on with the tanks that are going to be sent to Ukraine?
Well, I think the administration pulled off a brilliant scam in order to trap the Germans into supporting something they didn't want to support. And that was by saying, okay, we'll send tanks. And then we said, we're going to send 31. But then we added, they'll have to be built from scratch. We can't send the ones that we have because of various technologies involved in these tanks that we don't want to fall into the hands of the Russians. So we have to build a model that we can safely send to Ukraine so that in the event the tank is destroyed or is captured, we're not putting at risk sensitive technologies and capabilities. So now we're looking at tanks arriving in 6 months, 7 months, 8 months. And then the usual suspects on the Army side are saying, well, we'll have to build up an entire logistical infrastructure and network. Well, that's true. But that's something that people should have thought about before they launched this war. There was nothing in Ukraine to support anything beyond the first few weeks. So those tanks aren't coming anytime soon. Meanwhile, the Germans are now saying, oh, we can't send our best tanks either. We'll have to send old Leopards. We'll let our allies who have some Leopards send them if they like. They can do that. We give permission. But we're only going to send, I think the latest count from the Germans was 14. But then they assumed that all the other Europeans that have Leopard tanks would send those. And they said that'll bring your total to 88 or two battalions. Doesn't look like, with the exception of the Poles, the rest of them are going to give up their Leopard tanks. So I think, frankly, it's much ado about nothing. And again, anyone who looks at what's happened in Ukraine understands that warfare has changed rather profoundly. Warfare is not going to be dominated by armor on the ground as it once was. What dominates warfare today is something I've been writing about for 30 years off and on, and that is intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance linked to strike systems, rocket artillery, missiles, conventional artillery. That's what's dominating the battlefield. That's what's lethal. Now, sometimes it comes in the form of a small handheld weapon system, but most of the damage is really done by much larger, more powerful precision-guided munitions and missiles. The Russians understand this. They were the first to recognize this back in the 1970s. This is now being employed. So if you send armor anywhere without substantial air defense support to try and defeat these missile threats from drones, you know, from terminally guided systems, whatever, you're not going to have tanks for very long. You could watch 88 tanks vaporize in a few minutes. And at the same time, your infantry has to be there in the form of armored fighting vehicles with lots of firepower and, again, lots of overhead protection. Top attack from ISR strike dominates the battlefield now. Precision has made it extremely lethal. And that's why, if you look at the Russians, excuse me, they are moving very deliberately, very slowly, advancing under the umbrella of this ISR strike. They don't have to make any mad dashes to Kiev or across the river to hold something and wait for reinforcements. They have effectively created steamrollers. The steamroller is supported by this top attack system, the ISR strike complex, the overhead surveillance. And it's working very effectively. It's protecting their forces and absolutely devastating the enemy. And then as they need to, they move forward their armored force on the ground and their direct fire capabilities with the infantry and the armor, and they annihilate whatever is left after they've disrupted, disintegrated, atomized, you whatever words you want, the front. That front in southern Ukraine is crumbling. It's falling apart. It's almost completely destroyed at this point. And how many casualties the Ukrainians have had is anybody's guess. I've heard from 157,000 dead up to over 200,000 dead. I've heard 400,000 casualties. I've heard 500,000 casualties. No one is telling the truth in the West. The only way you can find these things out is by talking to people on the ground. Ukrainians, Russians, and Poles are very helpful. And they will tell you the truth. And the American people haven't been told the truth. And they don't understand that we are not in a position to go to war with anyone today. We're not. We don't have munitions factories, armaments factories, turning out equipment 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The Russians do. Their factories are humming. There's no shortage of anything. In fact, what they've done recently, according to the most recent reports I've seen, is that they've walked back from some of the major overhead strikes. They have the capacity to fire 60,000 rounds a day, including rockets and missiles at the Ukrainians. 60,000 rounds. But they've been walking that back, and the Ukrainians who are watching this, and the Poles and others are saying the Russians are husbanding these for the coming offensive. And this offensive is coming. There are 700,000 troops all the way around Ukraine. Of that number, probably 250 to 300,000 are combat forces. In other words, the people that actually go forward and kill the enemy. They're going to move. And when they move, this steamroller will go forward as I've described. And they will annihilate what is left. And it doesn't make any difference what you send to the Ukrainians. They can't be trained fast enough. There are not enough of them left anymore that can do anything. If you're starting to drag 16-year-old boys off the street, away from their families, into uniform, what kind of a situation do you think you confront? It's terrible. And it's not necessary. We've done this to the Ukrainians. This nation is almost destroyed. There are between 18 and 22 million Ukrainians left in the territory that Zelensky and his friends in Kyiv control. More than 10 million have left the country. 4 million are Russians living under Russian administration and are quite happy about it in the east. And then you have the casualties. And then you have 2 million that were already in the west working in the EU and Great Britain. And the sum at the beginning was never more than about 37.4 million. So this whole thing is a catastrophe. We're killing the Ukrainian nation. We're killing the Ukrainian state. And this is not something that was inevitable. But we were not willing to consider neutrality for Ukraine.
Yeah.
And yet we have decades of experience with neutrality in Austria that worked very well. When Austria finally secured neutrality, Eisenhower, who then was president, was greatly relieved. He kept saying, we don't have the forces to protect all these countries. Let's make as many of them neutral as possible. He wanted to neutralize Poland. He wanted to neutralize many of these states that are now part of NATO. He said, we can't defend them. We can't defend them now, Stephen. We can't.
Yeah. Final question. I know how busy you are. Thank you. This has been, I've learned at least a dozen new things. And I read a lot. So thank you for your wisdom. Is Washington, D.C. and NATO going to pull us into World War III? Are they going to trigger Belarus teaming up with Putin and coming in from the north? Are we going to be pushing Poland and Germany in? Or is this thing going to find resolution once Ukraine can no longer sustain itself and the money stops pouring in? Where do you see this going at this moment?
Well, the senior military leaders in the Pentagon know that we are not prepared for a military confrontation with Russia in Eastern Europe. They understand that. Remember, we are predominantly an aerospace and maritime power. We're prepared to defeat anyone who threatens the United States. Ideally, we'd like to meet our enemies somewhere in the mid-Atlantic or in the mid-Pacific, not on the Eurasian continent. Our army is pitifully small and pitifully incapable for what we would want it to do. It needs to be larger and more capable, but we've been destroying the armed forces now for a long time with all sorts of terrible policies that undermine discipline, cohesion, and destroy good leadership. So I think that we can avoid this confrontation. And I think there's a predisposition to do that. I think the amateurs in the White House recognize privately that they're in a lot of trouble. They've pushed this too far. And they're going to be embarrassed badly as they watch the steamroller eliminate what's left of the Ukrainian armed forces. Whether or not we at that point will step forward and admit, look, you're successful, you're victorious, we recognize that. We're prepared for some solution that guarantees neutrality for Ukraine. I don't know. If there's one thing politicians in Washington are loath to do, it's to admit that they're wrong, that they made a mistake. Nobody does it. But let's be frank, we have. We've made a very serious mistake. And this is destroying NATO. This is the other truth that hides behind the facade of NATO is more united than ever. Well, got news for you. No. Behind the scenes, lots of the people in Europe are asking the same question you are. What have we gotten ourselves into? I mean, NATO was founded as a defensive alliance. Nobody signed up for war with Russia. Oh, sure, you have, I think, dangerous, unbalanced people in places like Warsaw and Vilnius that talk about that. But ultimately, the majority of the population, the majority of the leaders inside NATO, they don't want to go to war with Russia, and they're no more ready for it than we are. They would like to see an end to this. We don't want it to end on terms that don't favor us. And we think the only thing that favors us is the destruction of Russia. It's humiliation. Well, that's absurd. Ultimately, everyone wants to get back to normalcy. We should want to get back to normalcy too and wash our hands of these bad policies. But until the American people realize that Washington is populated with these people, that the people in Washington, this ruling class, is not acting in their interests and demand fundamental sweeping change, I don't know how we avoid at least the potential for what you describe, because you can still have accidents.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to share this understanding, this wisdom, this information. You've got a brilliant military mind. I know you've written many books. You have one that came out recently. What is the name of that title? And I'll make sure to put a link below so people can look at that.
Yeah, Margin of Victory. And I think a lot of people would find it interesting because it traces the emergence of what we've been discussing, this new form of warfare, the links between space-based surveillance, reconnaissance, intelligence, and systems on the ground that are destructive and precise. And that's the way of war in the future. So adding 500 or 1,000 tanks is not the answer. We're still going to have tanks. We're going to have lots of things that we've had in the past in the future, not as many of them. There'll be different organizations, different designs. And that's what Americans have to understand. We continue to cling to the old World War II model. That's not the future.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Colonel McGregor, for your time and also for your service to our country. Have a great rest of your day.
Same to you, my friend. Thanks.
Bye-bye.